The 100 Years' War, the Gisclan period, Portugal and Spain, 1382, part 3. Now, the fortress town of Elva stood on a hillside crowned by a powerful 13th century fortress overlooking the plain of the Alentejo. 10 miles of wheat fields and olive groves separated it from the river Guadiana and the Castilian city of Badajoz. It was here that the English and the Portuguese army finally joined forces on July the 6th, 1382. The king was now very ill. His distended belly made it painful for him to move and difficult to receive visitors. He installed himself with his household in the citadel while the Earl of Cambridge occupied the Dominican convent, the lower town. Their followers were kept well apart. Portuguese troops encamped around the base of the town, while the English spread themselves along the road to Castile. Estimates of their strength varied, but the English appear to have been about 1,000 men at their disposal, plus the usual pages and camp followers, and the Portuguese about 6,000 men, equally divided between cavalry and infantry. John of Testamara's army was substantially larger, about 5,000 men at arms, including some French companies, in addition to about 1,500 light horse and hordes of archers and infantry. But they were still more than 100 miles away at Ciudad Rodrigo in the north. Although there were no Castilian troops opposite them apart from the garrison of the closest town, the Anglo-Portuguese army made no attempt to enter Castile. Instead, their leaders took up a Castilian proposal to fight an arranged battle on the frontier as soon as John of Testamara arrived with his army. He did not reach Badajoz until July the 31st. In the early hours of the morning, the whole of the Portuguese Anglo army advanced towards the frontier to meet him. The appointed place was a flat expanse, open ground, by a small hamlet in the town of Quia, 3 miles west of Badajoz. They drew themselves up in the battle lines, and the English in the van and the Portuguese behind. Fernando stirred himself to appear on the battlefield and began to confer knighthoods on ambitious young men, English and Portuguese, until it was pointed out to him that he wasn't entitled to do so, never having taken knighthood himself. The Earl of Cambridge dubbed him on the field so that he could repeat the process properly. It was a day rich in symbolism. In the front line, Sir Thomas Simmons unfurled John of Gaunt's Castilian banner as the English stood behind him roaring out, "Castile and Leon for King John, son of Edward of England." Then they brought forward the banner presented by Pope Urban VI to mark the crusade against the Castilian adherents to the Avignon Pope. On the opposite side of the field, no one stirred. The King of Castile was represented by a solitary pavilion which had been erected that morning by his officers. Shortly, they were seen to dismantle it and withdraw towards the city. The Anglo-Portuguese waited in line for several hours, and then in the early afternoon they withdrew to Elvas. Although they didn't know it yet, the campaign was over. On July 19, 1382, the Queen gave birth to a baby boy who died 4 days later. The child was assumed to be Andario's, but the king marked the birth and death with extravagant displays of joy and sorrow. Beatrice was once again an heiress. For more calculating men about the queen, the event paved the way for the reconciliation with Castile, which must have been planned within her circle for weeks. The probability is that on the first approach, which was made while the Castilian army was still way south of Badajoz at the end of July, and that the abortive arranged battle at Quia was no more than a charade for the benefit of the English. What is clear is that shortly after the retreat from Quia, the constable of the Portuguese army, accompanied by Goncalo Vasquez de Avendo, brought a formal proposal to John of Testamara's headquarters. 10 days of intensive negotiation followed. Portuguese emissaries received their instruction by word of mouth. To avoid attracting the attention of the English, they traveled by night with a single squire for an escort. The precise source of their instructions is something of a mystery. Fernando later told the English that he had nothing to do with the negotiations. This statement was received as mere subterfuge designed to hide his embarrassment, but it may well have been true. There is a weary, resigned quality about many of Don Fernando's pronouncements at this time. He was certainly not incoherent or incapable of following what was going on about him, but he was racked with pain and quite unable to stand up to the queen and his household officers. For his part, John of Testamara had good reason to make peace with Portugal in spite of the numerical superiority of his army and the enthusiasm of his leading captains. He didn't wish to risk a battle against an English army even in its present sorry state. In almost continuous service for more than a year, he was in serious financial difficulty. He could probably not keep his army in being for much longer anyway. The treaty between Castile and Portugal was finally concluded in the early hours of August the 10th, 1382. The terms were extremely favorable to Portugal. It was agreed that Beatrice's engagement to the Earl of Cambridge's son would be repudiated, and that instead she would be betrothed to the Castilian king's second son, the Infanta Ferdinando. Since he was barely a year old, Leonora was assured of a long regency after her husband's death, with some prospect of Castilian support against her internal enemies. The Castilians agreed to restore all that they had gained during the war, including the fortress of Almeida, and the whole of the Portuguese fleet captured at Saltes, and all prisoners of war in their hands. The English army was to be bundled out of Portugal as soon as possible. John agreed to make available ships of his own fleet to carry them back to England. The English knew nothing about any of this until on the morning of August the 10th, the trumpeters passed through their lines proclaiming the peace. They were astonished. They cried out that they'd been betrayed. Men were seen flinging their helmets to the ground and striking them with their axes. The Earl of Cambridge angrily declared that the treaty was not binding to him, and if he had not lost so much of his army, he said he would have carried on against the Castilians on his own. As it was, there was nothing he could do. During the following weeks, Portugal completed its diplomatic realignment by repudiating the obedience of the Roman Pope and declaring itself for Avignon. The Earl took a frigid leave of the king. Some of his Gascon men-at-arms and English archers decided to stay behind, take service with the Portuguese. Most of the Castilian exiles who had come with him to Portugal also stayed, and some of the latter made their own peace with the Testamarin dynasty. Sir John Sothery, the leader of the mutineers at Villa Vicosa, fled rather than face disgrace in England. 2 years later, he was tracked down in Aragon, kidnapped by the English government resident agent there, but appears to have died before he could be sent home. The rest of the English army simply followed the Earl of Cambridge west to a small port, Alamada, at the mouth of the Tagus River, opposite Lisbon, to await their passage to England. So, the disaster for the English in Portugal and Spain. So now we're going to have to see what's going to happen in Picardy and some other places. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.